Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
All right, on today's episode of Nothing Major, we are going to talk the February calendar, what goes on after the Australian Open. We also have an amazing interview from Ons Jabeur that we recorded about 6 weeks ago, so big thank you to her for hopping on the pod. And we also have awesome questions from our fans. Mailbag day. Let's get into it. All right, everyone, welcome back to Nothing Major. We've been something major for the last 2 weeks during the Australian Open, but we are back to the original title of Nothing Major. I'm joined by Jack Sock, John Isner, Steve Johnson, Charlie Fox, the team at SIFT. Australian Open is over. We're back to the normal grind of the ATP Tour, the WTA Tour. Next major is the French Open in a few months. I want to start with, I saw, John, on Twitter, you took a trip last week and you were in New York. You mentioned that the LaGuardia Airport used to be the worst airport in the world, which I could agree with. It has now transitioned. It's gone through a complete remodel. You claim it is now the best airport in America. Yes. So I thought maybe we'd start with, what is the best airport in America right now? I want an answer from all three of you. John, are you going with LaGuardia as the best airport in America?
It's LaGuardia. It's that nice. Yes. I think I would vacation there. I would just fly to LaGuardia. Hang out, like the Amex lounge is fantastic, and then just like get on a flight back. Is that nice?
Stevie, best airport in America.
This is going to get a lot of heat here.
Ooh,
I love LAX for me. So,
dude, Stevie, come on.
Well, what do you mean? I fly it every week or whatever. For me, the way LAX is a giant horseshoe. If you're Sam, if you're you who fly American, I think Jack flew Delta. Horrible, terrible. Awful, because it's in the back. For me, I flew United my whole career. You drive right in, you cut across, and 24 seconds later, you're out of there. No worries. All the United stuff was brand new. The lounges were awesome. I loved it there. So for me, LAX is not going to be a popular take. If you are having to change terminals, correct. Not very good. But for me, just getting to my destination of United couldn't have been easier. Was very happy with that airport.
It's got to be like a big,
I was going to say Long Beach because that's great, but you can't say that, you know?
Kansas City is like a mid-major. It's like a D2 yeah. school.
It's like in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
I will say their new airport is incredible, actually. Brand
you
new.
You couldn't help yourself. You just
had to. I mean, I had to. We got, yeah. And I'm probably maybe piggybacking with John here just because I feel like if you fly in for the Open and it was like depressing, you like get down the escalator to baggage claim there at the old LaGuardia and it was like,
it was awful.
And then the taxi, they're all the like aggressive taxi drivers. But so yeah, maybe the new LaGuardia. I don't know. I haven't been to an airport in the States where I'm like, wow, this has just blown my mind really. So
Tampa, weren't you in Tampa recently? Tampa's incredible.
Mid-major, it doesn't count.
Yeah. Tampa's mid-major?
Yeah.
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 Okay, fair enough.
I'm going Las Vegas. Great airport. You got the slot machines everywhere in a good mood. You got the chimes of the colors. You can win some money at the slots. They got good food. Got a nice tram. All right, let's flip. Give me the worst airport in the world.
Can I give the best and I give best international airport? Can I just
actually,
give
me sorry. Let's do that. Give me best international airport. We'll do that first.
Doha.
Yep, agreed.
Okay, it's unbelievable. All right, Doha. And worst airport in the world is Atlanta.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's so bad.
It's so bad. We all agree?
Atlanta's bad, dude.
Do we all agree Atlanta's like the worst airport in the world?
That was going to be my number one.
Chris Eubanks wrote me on Twitter, or on X, excuse me. He was like, what are you talking about, Atlanta? I mean, it's awful.
It's just straight chaos. There's 9 million gates. There's 90 million people.
If you're flying American or United, it's not as bad, but obviously Correct. It's 90% Delta. I mean, I'm typically flying Delta in and out of there. It's just horrible. It's the worst experience ever. It's miserable. There's nothing nice about it.
Usually the airports are a bit more segmented. Like, okay, like, you know, gates 1 through 30 are Delta, yep. you know, United, yep. American, whatever it may be. You go there. All 14 terminals have Delta flights. You have no idea where you're going. Like, you could be like, it's an hour walk from some of these places, and it is
the security lines. Even if it's, even if you're pre-check, it's
pre-check
outrageous.
Clear, pre-check doesn't and matter. Clear. It's impossible.
Doesn't matter what it is. Atlanta needs two airports, kind of like how Dallas has two airports, like DFW and Dallas Love. They need two airports because Hartsfield is not getting it done.
I despise taking trams and sky trams and not having to get places or like the and it's that it's all you do. I feel like when you're there.
Okay, we agree, Atlanta.
Let us know what you guys think on the comment. Atlanta's probably it's the worst airport in the world, not even America, the world.
Is that bad?
The world.
Is that
bad? Some of the best we got the new LaGuardia. A section of LAX. I've heard Minneapolis is nice. I like Vegas. Let us know what you guys think.
Yeah, just Terminal 7 at LAX. Nowhere else.
Terminal 7 specifically at LAX. All right, moving on. So it's that week in the calendar. Australia just ended. We've got Davis Cup this week. We got the next kind of big tournaments. We got Indian Wells in Miami in about a month from now. I want to know, I'll start with John. Like, this week in the calendar, it is the Davis Cup week. Did you find it tough sometimes? Were you excited for Davis Cup? You would be coming from Australia. You'd fly to Australia, fly all the way back. Sometimes 50% of the time you'd get lucky, you'd have a home Davis Cup tie when we played, and 50% of the time you'd have to fly somewhere else in the world. Were you excited for that Davis Cup week regardless, or sometimes did you look at it as, I just flew back from Australia, now I got to fly somewhere else in the world for Davis Cup?
I mean, it should be 50% of the time, but Sam, when you and I started playing Davis Cup, we were only on the road.
Only on the road for the first like
your first like eight ever Davis Cup ties were all on the road or something. First seven all on the road. So, but when I was in my 20s and, you know, I'm single, don't have a lot to look after, I didn't mind it. I get back from Australia and hang out for, you know, 7, 8, 9 days and get on a plane, go to Europe, wherever it may be. I didn't mind it at all. I actually quite enjoyed it. So I didn't, as I got older, became more of a burden to travel. I think so soon after a big trip, like going down to Australia, but when I was in my 20s, mid to late 20s, I didn't mind it at all.
I was the same. And Davis Cup weeks, as you guys know, are like some of the most fun weeks ever. Stevie, I want, if you didn't go to the Davis Cup, which a lot of times we weren't there, maybe we didn't have to qualify this week or we weren't on the team, was your motivation still really high? A lot of times, like, you're coming from the high of the Australian Open, a major, you'd come back to the U.S. We'd have tournaments in Memphis and Dallas and Delray, San Jose back in the day. Were you motivated to play those, or did you feel like, I just left a major and now I got a few random 250s in America?
No, I was always pretty motivated. Luckily for us, it was always in the States, so that it's just an easier hurdle to kind of get over. You know, flying, you know, at the very beginning of my career up to San Jose, you know, pop on an hour flight, go play San Jose, Memphis, Delray. Pretty simple trips, pretty straightforward. And we all play those events together, minus the 1 year John and Jack went down to Rio. But it was always great fellowship. You know, we'd get to these events kind of all on our own time, and all your buddies are there. You get to hang out, great dinners in the States. Places were very comfortable. So for me, the motivation was always high. Luckily, because we played in the States right after Australia, you kind of got back on your home ground, home footing, and really kind of, if Australia didn't go well, you could kickstart your career in a comfortable environment in the States for the next, basically for us through Houston. So it was a big stretch for us.
Jack, did you like that? The San Jose, Memphis, Delray, Acapulco swing, or was it just like another month long swing of random tournaments?
No, I liked like Memphis. I loved Memphis early on in my career. I loved walking over from the hotel and the club was really nice. And I don't know, it was a cozy tournament. Acapulco, I never did anything at, so indifferent there. And Delray, have some great memories from junior tennis, playing there up and you know, through professional. So, I feel like they were all just very comfortable tournaments, and it was kind of nice getting back from Australia. And then, like Stevie said, knowing that we have a stretch of tournaments in the States and we get to play in front of our home fans. And I had a great time of year.
Looking back on it now, like that stretch of tournaments, and it's a little different now because there's no Memphis, there's no San Jose. It's It's Delray Beach. It's Dallas, which is in John's backyard. We got Acapulco. The tournaments, they don't feel like there's – like maybe the players aren't as amped for that run of American tournaments as maybe like the summer. I feel like the events in the U.S. summer always felt like they had a little – maybe a little more excitement, or you're like a little more amped for it. But this is definitely a part of the year where if you put your head down, like I feel like a lot of times you could do some damage, you could pick up some points, because it was kind of, I hate to call it like a sleepy time of the year, but it's like kind of an awkward time of the year, especially for the higher ranked players, because you just came off the Australian Open. You've got like a 6-week period before Indian Wells in Miami, which you kind of highlight, but around the world, there's these big tournaments, and now Dallas is a 500, Acapulco, Dubai, I believe Doha is this time of year now, Rio. So it's a good opportunity for players if you can lock in to do some damage and kind of what I think is like kind of an awkward part of the season. You agree with that, Stevie?
Yeah, it's definitely if you are kind of ranked, let's say, you know, 20 to 70, like this is a huge part of the year where you could really do some damage and move your ranking, you know, solidify yourself being seeded in slams, or if you're like, you know, in that 70 ranking spot back when we played, when the Master Series were only, you know, 44 direct entries, like trying to get yourself up into the top 50 and into those events. So it's a big time of year for guys. You don't see the Novaks, Rogers, Rafas. Usually they'll play like Dubai and then Indian Wells, or not even Dubai. You know, they'll take 6 weeks off because they've just played, you know, won a slam, final the slam, or whatever it might be. So it's a big time for those guys who are ranked that lower to mid tier, kind of in the top 100, to really, you see some interesting results of guys, you know, 70 or 80, 90 in the world, you know, popping a 250. And it makes your year so much less stressful knowing you have that in your back pocket.
All right, let's move on. We're going to get into the Ons Jabeur interview. Amazing interview. Like we said, we recorded it 6 weeks ago. So thanks, Eric, for coming on. And let's get to the Ons Jabeur interview. All right, everyone. This is very exciting for us. We have a special guest today. We have Ons Jabeur joining the podcast. Fellow non-major winner. You've been way closer than the four of us. A couple Wimbledon finals, a U.S. Open final. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, and hopefully next time I can get another introduction, you know, as a Grand Slam champion or something like that.
Y'all want you to win a major. We're cheering for you. So yes, hopefully next time when we have you back on, it's a different introduction. What is it like growing up in Tunisia? Is there a tennis culture there, or is it a difficult place to grow up playing tennis at a high level like you did? Can you walk us through what it's like playing tennis in Tunisia as a junior?
Well, when I was really young, there have been like some tennis clubs, but not big ones. Most of the tennis courts were in hotels. So I don't know if you know the Club Med. They have a lot of tennis courts there, and most of the time you go and play there. Most of the people here, big fans of the older generation, McEnroe, Navratilova. So we're trying to, now they're following actually more and more tennis. I've been surprised that people, you know, as we call it here, football, but for you guys it's soccer, people are insane about it here. And now I'm happy that they're watching actually tennis. So that's been a huge change the last couple of 3-4 years.
Do you feel like you just said, like people there like McEnroe, Navratilova, your game is kind of a little more of like an old school style game. do you think that's why like your game is like that? Are those like, were those like pretty big influential people in your tennis game growing up?
You know what? I've been glad that my coach before let me do me on the court, all the slices and the volleys, and not kind of interrupt me and telling me to stick to one of game. But yeah, I think I got inspired a little bit also by so many players. I don't know if you guys know, but I love Andy. He doesn't play the same way as I play, but I'm hoping to have his serve or John's serve or any of your serves, actually. that would help a lot.
You're going to need to grow about a foot, Ons, and you might be able to rain down aces like that. Growing up in Tunisia, what are the courts like? Are they mostly clay court, mostly hard court? What is it like there?
The do you know Quick, the old hard courts before? That was a lot of those. Very cheap hard courts. And there was a lot of also clay. I've been practicing on clay a lot. So it's kind of weird because I've been practicing on clay, but I play good on grass. So I don't know how that happened, to be honest with you.
I think your style obviously is very different than most players out there. Some with, I mean, kind of unorthodox, but it's also super fun to watch. I personally love it. Kind of the drop shots, the coming in, like all that stuff. Is that something you've done since you were young and you just kind of crafted, or is that, did that come together kind of later on when you were playing?
No, I think I've been doing that for a long time. I think that's why it took me a long time to go from juniors to professional, because I felt like I had so many choices in my game that I couldn't choose one shot to do, and that kind of made it hard a little bit. So the slices and everything, I probably fire any coach will tell me not to do drop shots, because that would kill my game.
Speaking of the drop shot, everyone always talks about Carlos Alcaraz's drop shot, right? He's got a great drop shot. Do you get a little annoyed that people always talk about his drop shot? I feel like you came out with like the drop shot first almost. You've been using it longer than Carlos, and I feel like he's getting more credit, and you should be getting that credit that he's getting for using the drop shot.
Well, he has a really, I mean, good drop shot, because he kind of plays tactically with it. He doesn't know when he's going to do it. But I like to say he got inspired by me or something. I don't know.
All right, that's fair enough.
I'll put it that way.
There aren't many players on the ATP and WTA tour that use the drop shot so offensively as Ons and Carlos do. So it is nice to see, but you've been on tour longer than he has, so he's got to give you a little bit of credit, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
And half of his Grand Slams, probably.
There you go.
Yeah. All right, we want to move on and talk about your husband, Kareem. I hope I'm saying that right. You guys have been together almost 10 years now.
You guys
are working together now. My first question is, have you ever thought about firing him? Or is are things good with on the professional level?
Fire him for a day, but then he's back the next day.
Right.
That's exactly the maximum.
Sleep on the couch for a night, yeah.
Yeah, you know. No, but it was funny when we started working together, because obviously we were dating before, and then we thought maybe we'd try it and work, and he become my fitness coach. And first time he tells me to go around, I was like, don't tell me what to do. Like, don't give me. And then he was throwing the medicine ball, and he was kind of a bit far, and I was like, you don't know how to throw, you don't know how to catch. And I think the first session, I think, ended in 15 minutes.
Was it your idea to bring him on as like a fitness coach, or was it his idea and
both.
He tried to like persuade you?
Both. We were not, honestly, you know, how tennis players, they fly, and how expensive it is to have everything around. And we were like, let's try and be together and see how it goes. And I think we made the right choice.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you think it's easier or tougher working with someone like Kareem, who's so invested in, you know, in your career just as much as you are?
I think it is both, but I always say like the key of this is the communication between both. And I, since the day one we start working together, I told him like, if you don't like anything, you just have to tell me from the beginning. Just don't let things add up, and then obviously it will end up exposing, and we don't want that. We don't want it to affect obviously our personal relationship and our professional relationship. So that is very tough at the beginning to manage, but I think we have learned a lot. We fought a lot as well, but yeah, it's nice to be at this stage for sure.
Do you feel like any added pressure, like having him around or someone that close to you or someone that you love that's on your team, and things aren't going well or things are going well, or like balancing all of that, I guess?
I think I see it all in a positive way, that it's a dream that we both share and we both wanna, you know, achieve. And that's something, you know, I like it when he cheers for me, you know. It feels like extra energy coming from him, obviously, than someone that I don't really know.
The next question, like, this is something we know nothing about, and you've been somewhat open about this, balancing like possibly like motherhood with tennis. Is that something that you still think about on a, like a regular basis at this point in your career? And like, how do you balance that out? Like I said, like, we know nothing about that. We're not mothers, but how do you deal with that?
athletes in general, it is tough to take the decision. And I think after COVID, I kind of had like a baby fever. I was like, okay, maybe it's time. And then I don't know, it's going to take time to come back and play tennis. But at the same time, I was playing really good and I was kind of achieving a top 10. And it was a very difficult decision. But I love kids so much, and definitely I want to be a mother one day. And, you know, everything happens for a reason. Everything happens in their own time. It wasn't meant to be for me to be a mother before, and I'm sure it will happen very soon.
Yeah, Owens, have you spoken to other players on the WTA Tour that are mothers and are still competing, and about what they had to go through and what they're balancing now, being mothers still while still actively playing?
Definitely. I've spoken to Tatiana Maria. She has two kids. She's for me, she's the really great example for any mother to come back on tour. She made pregnancy look so easy. You know, she was 4 months pregnant and she was playing at Wimbledon. That was nuts, you know. So definitely every mother has a different experience. I don't want to have any expectations in the future. I can have it like really bad. I can take more time to come back, or I can come back very, very quickly. So I'm just going to see, but definitely I want to have a kid and come back one day.
She has two kids, right? Isn't her daughter like incredible at tennis?
Yes. She plays unbelievable.
Yes. I saw her at the Aussie Open indoor, you know, at the NTC, and she was hitting with her and she was incredible.
Yeah.
All the best to her. I don't want to put too much pressure on the girl, but she was really, really good. And she was like 5 at the time or something.
She practiced better than me probably most of the time. I see her in the indoor courts.
I want to see a tournament with players of ATP or WTA players currently, but like the 10 and under event to see who has the best 10 and under child right now.
I would bet on, honestly, Charlotte. She would be one of the best ones. I've seen her play and she's unbelievable.
That'd be sick.
I'd go watch that. Maybe like a junior Wimbledon. All right. Speaking of majors, you've finaled 3, couple Wimbledons. Is there, which one do you feel like you maybe had the biggest chance or best chance to actually get that title?
Definitely Wimbledon, and probably the first final. I was playing really good. I started the first set really good. And then I don't know what came to my mind. But it was a very close one. I think the closest one. The second Wimbledon final, I was really like tight and I was trying to relax and I couldn't find a way to just play my game and enjoy the game, you know, and that was really, really tough.
We've never gotten that far in a slam, but do you think getting that far and going down that path, is that more physical or mental at that point trying to win a slam?
It is both, but I would bet on mental. For me, if mentally I am ready, I can push myself physically. But I didn't really feel tired, but mostly mentally I was a bit like tense, stressed a little bit, and maybe a little bit tired, you know, 2 weeks of playing, you know, tennis, and especially in Wimbledon, like waiting, rain and all that stuff, it kind of plays with your mind.
Do you feel more pressure in a slam final compared to other events? You've won Masters Series Madrid, you've been in a bunch of other big finals. Is the difference between a slam final and anything else like a massive kind of difference, I guess, in the pressure you feel?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like you're like a step close to become a Grand Slam champion, and it's personally is one of my dreams. So I would definitely think it's either that or playing in Tunisia. That's two things.
So the one final, the second Wimbledon final that you lost, obviously that's not to bring up bad memories, but you went into that final as the favorite. I think it's a good learning lesson for any junior tennis player out there that mm-hmm. is the favorite in a match that they really want to win. If you could do it all over again, what would you change about your mindset prior to going into that match? Because as we know, we've been on the court against, you know, matches that we should win, but never in a slam final. The added pressure on that is enormous. So what would you do different given the opportunity going forward if you find yourself in another slam final as the favorite?
You know, I try not to look at that as much as I look at the match. You know, we both players, we have done, you know, a lot of great matches to arrive to the final. So I feel like, yes, it could be the favorite of the ranking, but obviously it's one match and anything could happen in a match. And for me, I would try to maybe tactically play different. I would try to relax as much as I can. Maybe the day before, I try to do different routines to, you know, just forget a little bit about the match and try to get ready. But again, I do believe that everything happens in the right time, and maybe it wasn't my time.
Jack has some doubles majors that we don't count. and I think the three of us, like, you know, I haven't asked these guys actually, but we're content in our careers. I think everyone's pretty happy with what we did. If, God forbid you don't win a slam, and we hope you do, will you be happy with your career if you end up not getting that slam?
It probably will take me some time to, accept that. But I would definitely be grateful for every moment that I have, because if I ask any player right now, would they take three Grand Slam finals? Everybody would say yes. And for me, I would probably have a girl and raise her, and she will win the Grand Slam for me. That's plan B.
Jack, would you trade in your doubles slams for one singles final slam?
It's a really good question.
One singles final
for all your doubles majors?
Financially, yes. I don't know.
Wow, you're a big dubs guy.
He's a big dubs guy.
Big dubs guy.
I mean,
don't ask him about his gold medal.
Okay.
He's not giving
this,
that.
This is what I do. This is what I do with Ons. Yeah. This goes Ons all the time.
All right. Enough about this. This isn't a Jack Sock interview. So we're going to move back on to Ons. What's your favorite part about the WTA Tour and just tennis in general?
Maybe traveling. I like discovering new cities. I like meeting new people. I think the crowd is one thing probably I would I missed honestly the most. That energy around it and everything. I love that so much. And I'm honestly, except that I don't miss a lot of things on tour for sure.
Outside of the Grand Slams, Ons, what is your favorite tournament? Actually, give us your three favorite tournaments outside of the slams.
I really love to play in the Middle East, in Doha, Dubai. It really feels like home, especially the crowd. You know, I never felt that much energy, people chanting my name and chanting, you know, Arab songs and everything around that. And I love Charleston a lot. I have won the tournament there, lost the final there, and I don't know, it feels cozy, it feels like people, real tennis fans there.
Charleston's amazing. I was at that event last year watching you play. Jack spends a lot of time in Charleston.
Charleston's a sick town.
Fantastic event. Kind of jealous that the men haven't gotten to South Carolina, Charleston in particular, but we always have a tournament concurrently. You know, Houston, fantastic, but Charleston is a super amazing place to play.
Who are some of your best friends on tour?
I mean, friends with Paola Badoza, Aryna Sabalenka, mostly, you know, we you know, I mean, we don't hang out a lot. I probably hang out more with Paola, but, you know, we talk about stuff. We get each other's opinion about, you know, the tour, the everything around what's happening, you know. We gossip. That's
all those girls are like fun girls to cheer for. I feel like that's like the cool girls club.
They are. That's exactly that's what I was thinking,
cool
dude.
Girls club.
They're nice.
Do you think it's tougher? Like, we've asked some people this before. Do you think it's tougher to get in the top 10? Or you, I'm going to ask, is it tougher to get in the top 5 or to just stay in the top 5?
Definitely stay in the top 5. Yeah, I think both are tough, definitely. But once you get in the top 10, you're not really very far from it.
I wouldn't know. I only got to 11.
to stay, I think the pressure of defending the points for me wasn't an issue, you know, because if you feel like you have the level, you will get the points anyways.
Was pro tennis, Ons, was that always on your radar, even as a young player when you were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old? Were you thinking pro tennis all the way?
100%. Yeah, the closest slam to Tunisia is the French Open, and I was actually spelling it very wrong when I was young. So I always said, like, I want to win this slam. And basically everybody was laughing and they didn't kind of believe that I could do it. And
kind of lighthearted here. Who's your least favorite players to play, or least favorite player?
Before you answer though, I think if we asked that to the other 99 women on tour, they would say you, because of the way you play. You've got like, you know, a very difficult, yeah, like awkward style.
I agree with that.
I gotta say, some players I used to not like to play them, given their style. But once you, like, you stay on tour a lot and you kind of have to learn how to play against them. I used to hate playing as Arena because the way she hits the ball, I basically could not see it. And I get frustrated from the speed, you know, of the ball. But people would tell me like, oh, you have the touch. And I was like, I think speed could definitely beat the touch, because if I cannot find it, then I cannot do it. So one of the players I didn't really like to play is Arena, but now I really enjoy our matches.
Is she also the most like intimidating player for you to play, or is there someone that is like the most intimidating player currently on the tour?
No, there is a lot. I think Iga is pretty solid player. You know, she doesn't give you any free points, which is kind of difficult to play with that. Coco is really amazing too. She plays unbelievable tennis. I think there is a lot of like solid players that you have to be, if not 100%, very close to 100% to play them that day.
I got one. You can't say yourself, okay? Give me one name on the WTA Tour, someone who has not won a Grand Slam that you would not be surprised that wins one, let's say 2025 or 2026.
I see Andreeva. She has maybe not 2025 or 26, but in the future.
How many times have you played her?
I played her once, and she really kicked my in Australian Open last year. But I was really surprised by her level. Like she has like really solid strikes, you know, for someone her age, you know. I can't remember I had that much power when I was her age, to be honest with you.
I've got another hypothetical. Would you rather win the Australian Open coming up? You win the Australian Open, then you never win a match ever again, or you never win a slam, but for the next 5 years you win a bunch of big titles and you're ranked like 2-3 in the world for 5 more years?
Australian.
Australian, then never again?
Yeah. I like to say never, but so I take the Australian and then see.
You take a Wimbledon over the Australian Open though, right?
Yes.
Okay, Wimbledon's got to be top.
Yeah, Wimbledon's everyone's favorite. All right. We've got a game section of this. This is like fun, random questions. So first question I've got for you, you cannot say Serena Williams.
Okay.
For any of these answers, because like she's going to be the answer to like half these. But if you could trade tennis careers with anyone, who would it be and why?
I mean, Venus. She had
That's a good one. Might have to take out the sisters.
Obviously, you've had some crazy journeys to big matches, probably met a lot of people, done a lot of cool things. What would be, if you could take one off-court moment and relive it, what would it be? Is there anything that's like off-court that's been just stands out?
I think it was Madrid final, when I won it there and my family was there, my little niece. And for me, I really love my family. I never see them much. So that moment was really something that it kind of felt from playing, you know, the national tournaments, the juniors, to getting Renat in a 1,000 WTA event. And it was really nice to have the family there.
Okay, Owens. What's one shot you would like to have from a current WTA player?
I was going to say your serve, but without finishing the question.
That's what everyone says. That's what everyone
says. I'm retired, and my serve stinks now anyway, so I appreciate that, though.
I would take Arena serve.
I think John would take that serve right now, too.
Yeah, she's got a big second serve, too. It's both serves, first and second. The reason why she's best in the world.
If you could only keep, right now, you only have your slice backhand the rest of your life, or only your drop shot, which one are you taking for the rest of your life? And you can never hit the other one again.
Tactically, it would be better to have the slice. So
it's
I think,
fun,
and I
though.
Use, I know, I know. It's not as fun. It's not as fun. It's boring. But the drop shot, I think, if it goes every time 100%, I would choose the drop shot.
So we did a thing with this commissioner of tennis where we had like a platform that we gave some ideas on how to you'd want to improve the sport or some fun ideas. If you were the commissioner of tennis, what would your platform be and what would your ideas be?
Definitely improve the schedule in general, the tournaments, everything that goes around, and the timing of the matches is very tough to know when you play. And I wish we were like, you know, the World Cup in football, where you know exactly which day every, you know, nation is playing, which I believe is very tough to know, but it would be very helpful with everything around it.
Do you have any resolutions for 2025?
I have a lot. Definitely health for me and for everyone. Obviously happiness for everyone as well. And hopefully a Grand Slam.
Hopefully. If you had to, and you can pick Stevie in this, he's not on the interview right now, but if you had to pick one of the four of us to be your practice partner for all of 2025, and you're stuck with us the entire year, whether you have good results or bad results, what one of us are you picking as your practice partner for the year?
What a four horrible choices.
Dude, this is, yeah.
You got horrendous choices. You have to choose one.
Wow.
I'm sorry, guys, but I would choose Sam because he'll also make cool videos.
And a great rally ball. It's like kind of best of both worlds.
He doesn't make the videos. He sends them off and they get cut.
He will connect me.
Those are not his ideas.
Would Jack be like the worst WTA like practice partner? The way, just because you hit the ball, you got like all the RPMs and then like a disgusting backhand. Yeah. It's like so, it'd just be.
No, I think I will have wrist pain because your ball is like super, like it's going super fast.
Used to
and
be.
No, I think it's still for sure.
Backhands cross drills would be tough. That's yeah.
I remember hitting next to you in Indian Wells, and I was like looking at how the ball is going. I was like, wow.
I'll take that.
His racket. Jack was stringing his racket at like 20.
I mean, it was the racket plus the string 30, combo. Yeah.
Yeah, 38. But what do you string your racket at on? What's the tension
I know going? In kilos. I don't know in.
In kilos, yeah.
It's like 24, 23.
Yeah, it's pretty.
We're going to go with 50 pounds. I have no idea.
I'm just going to double it.
I don't have my kilo to pound.
It's like 2.2 or something.
Did you have a favorite player? Like growing up, did you have a favorite player that you watched when you were little?
I really love Andy Roddick, Kim Clijsters, obviously the Williams sisters a lot. So, yeah.
We have a mini game or this going on the theme. If you had to build a perfect player using our four games here, what would you with serve, forehand, backhand, volleys, intangibles, all that stuff? If you had to build a player out of us, and you can use yourself in there.
Isner surf.
That's easy.
Wow. Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Actually, I love both your forehands, so but I like the spin of your forehand, Jack, so I would go with your
got one.
Sam, I would go with your slice. I like your slice.
Wow, I love that. Thank you. I think it's because Stevie's not a
dead fish slice.
If Stevie was on this podcast, would you still say my slice? Yes, no. That's a yes. No,
there's
come on.
No way.
That's great.
I don't think she's watched Stevie Johnson play a match in her life, so she wouldn't.
No, have. I did.
He's catching strays.
That's right. Watched him play a match, so it's okay to say you haven't.
But I would choose both your forehands. I really love both. It's like a different style of forehands, for sure.
Who's winning the slice-to-slice backhand rally, you or Steve Johnson?
No, we have to try. Now, maybe me. Is he playing tennis right now?
I played with him yesterday. He can still hit a slice backhand. But all right, let's go back to build a perfect player. Who do you have for the volley and the speed?
Jack's speed, your volley, and my drop shot.
Gotta have the drop shot.
Last one, mental game. We got another mental game.
Oh God.
Or you could just say none of us and just take your chances. Yeah. With,
No, I would go with John. He has more.
Yeah, John's pretty solid upstairs.
Yeah.
I would think I was a little overrated upstairs, truthfully, but I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. We got one final one for you, and then you can go to sleep. I know it's late in Tunisia. Is there a topic that like you're never asked that you wish people like us or other reporters or someone in tennis would ask you or other players every once in a while?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of things, but maybe first thing that comes to mind is, you know, all the betting and the abuse that kind of players get on social media. I think we don't talk about that a lot, and I think maybe they don't know really what's happening and the kind of messages that we receive. Obviously, some players have more experience than others, but there is a lot of young players coming up, and they don't know how to deal with the social media abuse. So I think it's a very important topic to address, and definitely maybe changing the betting system that is happening around the tennis, community.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys feel, but Anji, it's hard not to read those messages sometimes, don't you think? If you win a match, or especially if you lose a match, and then you go back and like open your phone, and you probably get way more than we get.
I do get a lot, and some things are really like very extreme, you know. But yeah. I think I got used to it. I would not say I do not care. I obviously do care, but I know at the end of the day, I remind myself that these people are like hopeless and behind the screen. They just they don't have the guts to say that to you, you know, face to face.
We feel the same way. They are they're losers. They're losers, unlike yourself. All right, that's all we got. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Hopefully, you can.
Thank you so much.
That elusive major in Australia in 1 month.
And yeah. For you, for the 2025 season with me, remember?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you do. Are you hiring me right now as practice as heady partner?
Did that just happen?
Right. Should I be heading to the airport?
I'll send the coach.
All right. Good luck. We'll be cheering you on.
Best of luck.
So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, that was an awesome interview. Thank you so much again to Anj Jabeur for taking time out of your day and jumping on the podcast with us. Now we're going to get into mailbag. Our fans, you guys wrote in some questions, so we're going to pick. I love these parts of the pod. Fan questions are some of the best. So we're going to go through some of them. First, I'm going to start with. This is the worst part of the pod for me, reading these names.
Best part for me.
All right, this one's for everyone. I'm going to start with Jack. Francisco Ola, 1723. I don't know if you guys saw Shelton mention at the Australian Open, if someone beats you three times in a row, he's your daddy. I want to know, everyone on the pod, who was your daddy on tour?
A lot of people.
multiple daddies.
Yeah. I lost to Rafa three or four times, so I'm going to give him daddy status on that. But along with a bunch of other people.
John, who's your daddy?
Okay.
Outside the big three, if possible.
I got a good one, and I'm looking up because I was always ranked higher than this player.
I think I know who you're going to say.
Who?
Karen Khachanov.
No, he is my daddy too, though. But I even better than that. Shardy.
Really?
Yeah. I was 0-5 against Shardy. I couldn't beat the guy.
Whoa.
I had match points on him, and
Stevie, who's your daddy?
We've spoken about this on the podcast. It's Roberto Bautista Agut. As I'm looking it up, 7-0 in a 5-year span, and one match I had match points in the middle. And other than that, I pretty much packed my bags and booked a flight the next day. I mean, pre-match, so that was a bad sign.
Mine early on was Adrian Mannarino. 0-5 yes. Against him to start. I just couldn't figure it out early on in my career.
Makes no sense to me because I was his daddy.
You guys would – Stevie would crush him. John would crush him. I don't know.
I was 9-0 against him.
Yeah, I don't get it.
He beat me at the Aussie Open at the end of my career, legit, and then he beat me at Wimbledon 1-0 retired. Doesn't count. I was 9-0 against him prior to our last
John, it didn't make any sense because there was the stretch there where CB was coaching myself and Sam for a long period of time. Yeah. I had a great record. I had beaten him like four or five times in a row. Pretty straightforward. And Sam, like arguably the best tennis player of our group from the ground, I think, like all things considered, was so darn stubborn against Mannarino. Like I was just kind of telling him, can you just do this or do this, like little things? And he's like, no, I'm just going to keep hitting through him. And eventually it got to the point I was like, once you beat him once, you are never going to lose to him again. And I think you did that in Long Island, right?
Yeah. I flipped it, went like 4-0 on the back end.
And then so I was like, you're going to beat him once and figure it out. And he did. But it was just funny because I was rooting for him to go, 12-0 against Sam, just because it would be funny that Sam has wins over, Nadal, Novak, Murray, all these guys. But he couldn't beat Mannarino.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, at Bounty Tennis, do you guys ever wish you were able to play in this current era of tennis? Would you find more success? I'll start. The answer is yes and yes. I do feel like I would have been higher than 11 in the world if I was playing in this current era. I might have got to 10, and I feel like I would have gotten more success. Not to say these guys aren't good. I feel like the era of tennis 8 to 12 years ago was a little bit stronger than it is right now from top to bottom, from like the 1 to 50 range. I feel like it was stronger in 2015 than it is in 2025. Let me go to John. Are you on my side with this, or am I just being that guy that thinks everything was tougher in his time?
Angry guy that, you know, screams at the cloud or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know, a little bit. But the way these guys move now, I think the answer for you guys is probably yes. Maybe not for me, because everyone moves so well now.
Yeah, that's
fair enough. Sorry, I gave a bad answer there.
You gave a horrible answer.
I know.
Let's go to Stevie. Let's go to Stevie.
I'm with Sam. I'm going to be the old guy screaming at the clouds. I fully think that the outside the top three, you know, back in the day, like, you know, the Ferrers, Burdich, all Wawrinka is like way better than the guys now from, you know, 5 to 15 on a consistent daily basis, week in and week out. So, yeah, I'm with you on that one, Sam.
Jack, would you have been better?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think if you take out the top seeds at each slam and you do seeds 6 to 32, I would take my chances playing all of our, in our primes, playing our best tennis, take my chances against those guys having to try to get through a slam draw than the guys that were probably 6 to 32 in our day. Like John said, you got some guys that were
nasty,
disgusting, that were even between 10 and 20, like you didn't want to see.
All right, let me go to another one. Ariop8434, what's the most unique pregame ritual that you've seen from a fellow player? Jack, do you remember any player on tour that had like a crazy pregame ritual? I honestly don't. I can't think of anyone.
I think
going
the guys
back
that could nap really well were kind of, that was always a little like,
yes.
You ever see those guys? They're like just fully laid out. Like, I think Rublev does it a lot, or.
Dude, the South Americans. No one can nap like a South American.
Diego Schwartzman always naps.
Pablo Cuevas is the greatest napper of all time.
Yeah.
The South Americans. They get like some mate or something, and like after they wake up.
It's crazy. They just like fully zonk out, and then they wake up and go play like a five-setter. I was like, wow. It's,
I don't think I've taken a nap in 25 years.
Yeah, I don't take naps.
Sam, you wouldn't, if you knew you were playing at 9 p.m., would you not try to schedule a nap?
No. Would you?
Look, I would try to. It is a massive advantage for players. Like Sasha Zverev talks about how he loves playing at night, because he'd go to bed at 3 in the morning. He'll sleep till 12, no problem. So he's like fully recovered. The best way to recover is with sleep. It's not with the ice bath. Yes, that helps. With food, yes, that helps. But the number one best way to recover is with sleep. And I always struggle with that, especially all of us, you know, with kids. It's like when your body gets used to getting up early, brutal. And I played the Cabo tournament. It was the second to last tournament of my career. I won my first match and I was playing Tsitsipas. I was in that third night match from 6 o'clock. I took the court at like 11:45 midnight against Tsitsipas. I had been up since like 6 a.m. Wasn't able to nap. It was a nightmare. I got crushed because I felt so bad out there. But I was a horrible napper too. So it's not fun. That's one of the reasons I really dislike night matches, because I just didn't nap. I think all of us were kind of creatures of habit. We like to play first or second up. That's when we're most alert.
You're either a napper or you're not.
Jack was a night guy.
Yeah, I wanted fourth on every tournament, every match.
Ben Biswas, 1766. Question for you. He gives who's your top five list of journeymen? I don't want like the top five list of journeymen. I just want each of us to give a journeyman. He's kind of asking in the 40 to 80 range. Give us like the ultimate journeyman ranking like 40 to 80 for like a decade. I'm kind of defining the journeyman. It's always a tough criticism. As that guy basically ranked 75 in the world, give or take 25 spots. Like they're always in every major, mm-hmm. but they maybe didn't, they never won a tournament, but they always were just in every major and a tough out and didn't their ranking didn't vary that much from that 75 in the world.
They knew what they needed to do to be main draw of the slams, and they would play. They would dip in and play a lot of challengers. They would play 10 challengers a year, and you know, 15 ATPs, 20 ATPs a year, whatever it is. Yeah. So I have the answer. I have the perfect answer.
Oh, you have the all right. Let me.
It's Paolo Lorenzi.
Paolo Lorenzi. He's a good one. I was thinking of the exact same player.
Yeah,
I got I got an American one.
I think I know what you're going to say
Vince Spadia.
Spadia had some highs though.
He was top 20.
Yeah.
Career high, 18.
I thought you'd say like Mikey Russell. I mean, he kind of took pride in
like he was never, he was always an afterthought at every tournament. Like he was never the guy, was there for a long time.
I'll give you a C minus for that answer.
Part-time rapper, now luxury real estate salesman, you know?
C minus for Stevie on that one.
What? Yeah. That was not a great call. He's top 20.
That was bad. Jack?
I'm going to go with Radu Albot.
Radu, that's your answer for everything that we do on this podcast.
It is. It's everything. But it also fits into this category very well.
That is a good one.
He's in every 250. He finds his way into some 250s somehow in smaller draws, plays his 10 challengers, stays just inside the slam line.
Very good one. Lorenzi, though, ultimate journeyman.
You can go with a few of the Italians.
Yeah.
Lorenzi.
Filippo Volandri.
Yeah. He was a journeyman.
That's it. Let's move on. That's it for Nothing Major Pod. Before we get into trivia, you guys subscribe to us. We're on YouTube at Nothing Major Pod, X, Instagram, TikTok. For the moochers that aren't subscribing, we know who you are. So just subscribe. Like, we will find you if you're mooching and not subscribing. That's going to come back to bite you in the butt. So just subscribe to the podcast, please. We need it. You can put your questions in there. We'll get to them. Audio podcast drop every Friday, and then we are on YouTube every Monday. So with that, let's get us some trivia. Okay, for trivia this week, Steve Johnson is playing host for trivia. So Stevie, what is the question?
Yeah, this is with a little help from our good friend Greg Sharko, who is an absolute legend on the tour and the media side of things, knows anything and everything about tennis. So I had asked him I had seen this article kind of pop up, and, you know, I want you guys to guess total number of men's singles slam wins by decade, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Like the number of how many slams have been won by guys born in that decade. So in the 1980s, 1990s, and the 2000s.
I'm going to say 80s, like there was 80 slams won. 90s, I'm going to say 5, and 2000s, I'm going to say 7.
I like Sam's answer from the 80s. Just thoroughly dominant with three guys in particular. The 90s, I'm going to like 1. I think it's like an outrageous number. 1. And then the 2000s, we're at 7.
7,
It's 7, yeah.
I feel like Jack has nothing to add here. I feel like he's on the scent.
Yeah, we're on the scent.
I think for my decade in the 90s, I would think, you know, I'd like to have a lot more, but I think it's a small number as well.
Yeah, it's been dominated. The 90s really let everyone down. Two, Medvedev and Thiem are the only two guys that have won a slam born in the 90s. Zverev has had some chances. Sam was all over it. I'm sure he's seen this stat before, but it was 80.
Was it? I've not seen the stat. I swear on my life, I have not seen the stat. Guessed 80.
It was 80 for the guys born in the 80s.
Don't look at me. I have not seen the stat.
And 7 for the guys born in 2000s. That's Sinner and Alcaraz. So the 90s kids need to kind of figure it out and win some slams because the 2000s are passing them.
Yeah.
Have passed them by a long shot here. And I don't think it's ever going to catch up.
I'll start my comeback now.
Singles, Jack. Singles only.
That's good trivia. 80s guys crushing it. All right. We'll see you guys next week.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.